You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Rita Reed. She's an artist, and we're going to talk a little bit about her life and career. Rita, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, Brainerd, thank you so much for asking me. I appreciate it.
Let's talk a little bit about what you're working on now. I know something about your paintings. I've seen them on Facebook and, of course, know you as well. What is it that you're working on at the moment, or has what's been the most recent series of paintings you've been working on?
Well, I have been working on two series of paintings. Endless April is one series, and it's quite large, and Light Shift, which are small, 6 by 6 inches. I've had to change my style from realism to expressionism. I like to think I paint hope because I have become legally blind in the last 4 years due to macular degeneration. I used to be a realist, and now I'm not. But I like my, this is more fun, however.
So what does that mean exactly, legally blind? I mean, I don't know exactly how that happens. I understand macular degeneration, but you're able to obviously see enough so that you can paint a canvas. But what is it that you can't see, or what begins to happen with macular degeneration?
Macular degeneration causes me to be blind in the center of my eye, where the nerves come in. It's just scarred over. If I looked at your face, I would see a peach blur, so to speak. I do have some peripheral vision in my left eye, a little bit on the top, more on the side, and on the bottom. I can function in my home. I can function outside. If I go outside, I use my blind stick if I've not been into a place before. I just don't trust where stairs are or anything. So I've had to change my style, and this came up, and I really am enjoying it more than realism, because realism is making you paint what's there, and that's not fun. It's more fun for me to paint what's not there.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, to paint what's not there, you're also painting what you're seeing in a way, you know, or not seeing. But you said one of your eyes obviously has more sight than the other, so peripherally you are able to see with clarity. I mean, enough so that I know it wasn't easy, but when I sent you the phone number to call in for this interview, you were able to read that. So there's an ability to read with peripheral vision of one of your eyes? Is that how it works?
Actually, no, because it doesn't focus. It takes the center eye to focus. What I have and what most visually impaired people have is a machine called a CCTV, which works like what you have on the corner of stores. But this is has an XY tray. It is autofocus, and it zooms larger. So I wrote down the numbers to call the conference call, and I had a hard time because it only took me 4 times to find the numbers on the phone. So I can't see really well. But in my painting, I've had all my life, I just have, with an MFA degree, I know composition, I know values, I know color theory, I know emotions. So I paint what's not there, but I paint emotions. So how do you paint hope, for example? I read Edward Hopper, and I'm going to be paraphrasing Edward Hopper, the famous New York painter of realism, Nighthawk. So he wrote, "If I had the words to express what I want, I wouldn't have to paint."
Hmm.
Now that's powerful.
That's powerful.
Very powerful.
Hmm. And let's move back a little bit to understand more where you're coming from. What was it that, and this could be way back to when you're a child, or as far back as you want to go, but do you remember your first introduction to art or what got you interested in art to begin with?
Well, the first I remember when I was 7 years old, my mother told me I was going through way too many papers, drawing on them. I don't remember that, but I do remember the empty jar that she filled with water, and she gave me a 2-inch house brush and said, go out on the sidewalk. This is back in Iowa in the summer, hot sun. So when I started painting a scene, by the time I got to the end of it, well, it had evaporated, and I could start all over again. It satisfied my need. I'm an artist, you know, that's genetic or whatever. That's what I am. I have to.
And then what happened from there? That was when you were a child. Did you go to art school, or how did you decide that you were going to continue making art?
Well, by the time I got to high school, it was evident. Well, I did my first oil when I was 13. I had painted a horse's head on the tie for Uncle Joe that he wore once, you know, that sort of thing. But by the time I got to high school, it was realized I had artistic talent. So I was given a scholarship to college, an art scholarship. So I was graduated from Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. And then several years passed, and then I went after my MFA in Winthrop, Rock Hill, South Carolina, which is the closest who offers a master's of fine arts degree. And from there, I taught a lot in college, which I loved, like undergraduate, high school or junior high. So I loved teaching in college. I got to be known as a portrait painter. I was hired by many, many people and commissioned by the United States government, military, various branches to create historical paintings. Now, these are not historical paintings back in the day. These are historical paintings that are happening while I'm there. And that is scary.
Let's talk a little bit about that. So this is after you got your MFA, you're painting, you're doing portraits and other things,
uh-huh.
You're teaching. And then you
get
this commission from the government that's asking you to paint historical scenes. What did that mean? That sounds like such an unusual commission. What year was that? When was that?
It was in the late 80s. They probably do it a little different now. Because nobody has money, except some people in the government or whatever. But for example, I was sent on an icebreaker. They either had to love me or hate me. First of all, I won an award in the Coast Guard art show and was given the George Gray Award, and from that excellent painting, I was commissioned to do 1, 2, 3 commandants who had the 4 stars on their shoulders, and 1 admiral who was the World War I Pacific Naval head, and that painting is in Naval Institute in Annapolis, Maryland, in their museum there. And I was just happy going along that way. Let's see, I was sent on an icebreaker. It was the very first test.
So wait, let me stop you for a minute, because I want to hear about the icebreaker, but it's very exciting. So to begin with, you were doing portraits of major figures in the Army that's not so much a historical moment, but it's these historical figures that will be remembered, and to the Army,
it would be their official retirement portrait I was commissioned to do, which would be theirs in the branch to be hung like judges on the wall and the jury law building. And from there, and I would include people because I paint people well. I painted very well. They started sending me on commissioned field trips, so to speak. And I can't stand on the deck of a boat with my easel and paint. So I did lots of sketches, lots of color notes, lots of photographs. And the color of broken ice made by an icebreaker is unbelievably blue-green. It's like the green flash of a setting sun over into the ocean. It's just absolutely gorgeous. But it, as the first test towing, and they had scientists from Norway, Sweden, all and us, and all the to see how much strain on the rope or the chains or whatever it would take to pull a frozen in vessel free of the ice. Now, being on an icebreaker myself, we were frozen very quickly. I could see the ice, I could look over the rail of the deck and see the ice crystals form, and they form very quickly. But our icebreaker not only had an engine in the back that pushed us forward and reversed, but it also had side thrusters. So we side thrusted our way out of the ice, then backed up and took a running start if there was a ledge of ice, for example, which there often is, and crashed down on top of it. But it was interesting. So the final painting included one scientist from the United States, a very nice-looking man, and one scientist, I think, from Sweden, another nice-looking man, who were out taking notes on where they were going to, they had a drill to see how thick the ice is, more than I would ever know. In the meantime, I'm worrying, what in the world painting am I going to make out of this? But anyhow, success followed. There we are.
So, but another, so I want to know a little bit more about these icebreakers, and you're out there.
Yeah.
You're painting. What are you sketching? What are the scenes that you're sketching? You're actually sketching scenes?
No. I'm good at people. I was good at people. Remember, I did portraits.
Right.
So I can look at somebody and I can have an excellent resemblance. So I figured out the composition on the ship, and I had these two guys posing for me in the camera. One is looking off in the distance and pointing. Now, this is on the ice sheet, and the boat is a little bit in the distance. They are on the ice sheet. I am too, and pointing over in that direction. As if, I mean, there were total whiteouts. I couldn't tell where he was going. I could point in the direction like, well, let's see what the thickness of the ice is. Well, the other scientist is madly scribbling notes of great import, I'm sure, on his notepad. So it was fun.
That sounds fantastic.
The captain said, this is going on way too long. The captain had asked me, would you like to go out on the ice, Rita, and see what it feels like to have the an icebreaker go past you? So I went out about 500 yards. I had to climb down a ladder, like three stories, to the ice, and I walked out about maybe 300 yards. And he got the boat started and free from the frozen ice, and it felt like an earthquake under my feet. So I went
Amazing.
Back to the ship, and I climbed back up, and I said, thank you, Captain. That was an interesting experience.
Wow, must have been scary, I would think.
It was fun. I'm rather adventuresome, but that was fun. I have one more to tell you about, and that's the Atlantic War Games. Again, the military do this every 2 years, and they were focusing in on terrorists, of course, and I was given a neutral badge, so I could go either with the good guys or the Army, the Navy, it's all the together, up and down.
Okay, one minute. Let me stop you just for a moment, because this is fascinating. So this is what year now that this is happening?
Late '80s or early '90s? Yeah, I forget. I don't.
Okay, these are kind of war games that they're playing.
Yeah, every two years, all five branches get together, and it's planned.
And where would they take place?
Well, from New York to Honduras, and I boarded the ship at the Morehead City Harbor, where I went. But then I was given a liaison man to make sure I didn't get into any trouble. As I was saying, the good guys were played by the Marines. There are Navy SEALs there. My goodness, what legs they have. They wouldn't let me come near them with a camera. No, that's certainly off limits. But the Marines, the Coast Guard, the Navy, the Army, all the five branches participate every 2 years in these mock wars. They're set up ahead of time, I'm sure, and da-da-da-da. And the men who play the terrorists have terrorist labels on them, but they are the specialists in all branches who have dealt with the terrorists, and they know their ways, and they know what they would do. And so I chose, as a neutral badge person, to go with the terrorists, because that would be far more interesting. If I went with the good guys and sat on a bridge all night long, it wouldn't get blown up, maybe. But if I went with the terrorists, they might do something very interesting, which they did. And we succeeded in shooting down the, this sounds horrible, laughing about it, the headquarters tent.
And so what were you doing? That's amazing. So what is your actual position? Like, are you on a plane or what is happening?
I was on a ship. I was on several ships. I was on a motorboat driven by the harbor master, who knows all the ins and outs and was the chief terrorist in our group. And he was able to troll around like we're doing, la, 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 this isn't wartime. And because the aircraft carrier had come in, and they were squawking over my person's radio, and said, "Do you know they're talking about you?" And I said, "No, what are they saying?" "Well, there's somebody on the bridge who has spotted you with a camera. And they're saying, because it's suspicious times, and it's about war, and they're saying, who is that woman with the camera in that boat?" So that was interesting.
It sounds like I know it's a game, but it also sounds dangerous.
Well, that's why I had a liaison person, so I wouldn't, they don't want headlines, "American artist falls overboard," so to speak. So I had someone with me all the time, pretty much. I was on a helicopter. At that time, we were taking sounds off the coast for Russian submarines that might be there. Let's see, that I was on, can't remember it all. But anyhow, it was interesting, and they got a nice painting out of it. So there you go.
That's exciting. And so that's a pretty unusual assignment for an artist, a painter. I've interviewed a lot of artists. Never heard of anybody on an assignment like that sounds daring and thrilling and, you know, what an adventure, right?
There are other artists. I can't say I was the first woman. I certainly can't, because there probably were other women on other assignments. But I was... and the head of the league of female journalists going to war type of thing. I was surrounded. I was very well taken care of. I was surrounded by men, and it was just extremely interesting. Extremely.
Fascinating. That's just fascinating. And so what happened after that?
Well, the time was up, and then everybody went home. Yeah, it was there for, I think, for a week.
And then that was it. And then did you do more for the military or no?
Yeah, afterwards, yes. Mm-hmm. And for NASA, I did painted. I had three commission trips down to NASA for their blast off, and with no disrespect, I painted Columbia, which broke up over the western part of the United States. And when people look at me and they say, "What did you do, climb a ladder and paint it before it took off?" I said, no. I had painted it, so that's a bit of history.
But what do you mean? How did you paint it? How? In other words,
it was in one of my paintings as it was being trailed out to the launch pad by this huge tractor that goes 5 miles an hour.
Hmm.
If you recall seeing that.
I do, and it's fascinating that you had these kind of commissions. Did these just come to you? They were just calling you. Once you had one, they would keep calling you to do more. Is that how it worked?
That's how it would work. With NASA, while I was in Washington anyhow, because there were many parties for whatever, the celebration of the retirement of the whomever, top four-star admirals, I stopped at NASA headquarters in Washington and asked, you know, see the person in charge of their art. So I left my card and so forth, and they had seen my previous paintings, and so I got that commission. Oh, can I still go on? Posthumous painting of the admiral his great grandson commissioned me to paint the admiral who in World War I was the commandant of the Pacific Ocean, and I didn't even know we had a navy in the Pacific Ocean in World War I, but evidently we did. I was given a black and white photo with a cocked hat. The braided epaulets, the braid is coming down the shoulder, all his ribbons. And they always sent me their ribbons. They always have a copy of their ribbons because that's very important. So I got all his ribbons and medals hanging on him, his belt with his sword, and his folded white gloves, which were very much of the costume of the admiral in World War I.
Wow.
So being a black and white photo, I wanted it to be historically correct because that's what I always am. Mm. So was navy blue now the same as navy blue then? So I called up the Nimitz Library in at Annapolis at the Naval Academy. And I was given the research historian there, and I said, "Is the navy blue then the same as the?" And yes, it is. Very good, because it's almost black, if you will recall. It's hardly any blue at all. But yes, the navy blue is correct. And because this great-grandson wanted the flagship of his grandson. Whatever, great grandfather. I had to call the Nimitz Library again and said, "Well, is the ship gray paint used now the same as the gray paint used in World War I?" And she said, "No, but I'll send you a chip of that paint so that you can match it." So I did.
Wow, that's fascinating. And I mean, that's a, it seems a major part of your professional growth and career as an artist, those commissions. We were also teaching at the time in between all of these gigs.
Part-time teaching a college here, and I enjoyed it. I was not teaching full-time. I didn't want that. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what was the next step? Were you in the, so this is late 80s, early 90s. What's Rita doing in the late 90s, early 2000s?
Well, in the late 90s, I found the love of my life in California. And long story short, we're married and living here in Charlotte and very happy. And I was still teaching, but not going away so much. And then iDefect started to come in, and I didn't realize it. I don't think people do. It comes on so slowly. The first thing I noticed was driving home from class in the rain at night, and I couldn't see the white stripe on the road, which is not a good thing. So I just followed the taillights of the car ahead of me in the kind of direction I was going. And then I started noticing, and little things, because I have glaucoma too. So I've had 6 eye operations. That's what I was doing in 1990s. 6 eye operations. And eventually I was told, I have early signs of macular degeneration. Come back in 6 months. You have macular degeneration, Rita. So he knew it back then, the eye doctor. But and I went through probably 2 years of rage and anger, because I am an artist and I need to see. So I went through 2 years of could have wrestled the refrigerator to the floor. I was that angry, as you might imagine. So then I can't do this all the time, really. So I tried the little polyclay, thinking 3 dimensions. It didn't work. And I thought, well, let me try something else. And I tried this abstract expressionism type on the larger canvases, which are the Endless April series. And it worked. And I wanted to be, but I'd have to create them and ship them out. And I can no longer drive. I can no longer read, actually. So I had to go small. I couldn't drive them to galleries back and forth. So I chose to go smaller, 6x6, that could be slipped into a Priority Mail envelope. I sold a little bit on eBay, but I had to read too much, and it was very confusing. So right now I'm selling it off my web page and Facebook, which leads to the web page. So I'm happy. It's great. I love it.
So that was a powerful thing to get over. I mean, the anger and what you went through, and
yeah,
what came out of that was you began reinventing how you work and how you use your eyes, which is to be creating these abstract works, which, as you're saying, is more emotional, really.
It is. When I think of abstract, I think more of linear forms and shapes. I don't know whether that's true or not. But mine are very colorful, very emotional, full of gesture. I'm told I have so many nice comments on my Facebook page, but powerful is one word. Bless your soul, Rita. It's just so beautiful, and it just strikes people in a nice way, which is my thing.
Well, thank you, Rita. It's a very, your story is very, exciting, thrilling, and also inspiring, and I'm so glad you shared that with us today. For those listening to this, there's links to Rita's website and Facebook page in this interview, so thank you again so much, Rita, for being part of the show today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you, Brainerd.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIVC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.